Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Tuesday, September 20th, 2016. Lots of news crossing my desk today. I've got a snip from an exclusive interview with former Senator Bob Graham about that 28 pages from the 9/11 investigation that were partially released this summer, or they were released partially redacted, let me put it that way. But first, I want to start with some very good news. Last week, I led the podcast and brought you some significant coverage of a boneheaded move suppressing academic freedom and freedom of speech at the University of California at Berkeley. And today, I'm happy to report to you that the administration has relented. And Carla Hess, Dean of the College of Letters and Science, wrote to faculty members Monday announcing the reinstatement less than a week after she suspended the course called Palestine, a Settler Colonial Analysis. Now, this is a very important victory for speech rights and academic independence. And I want to salute Paul Hodway. He grew up in Palestine. He is a student there. He went through all of the channels and processes to secure approval for this course. Nevertheless, Carla Hess, the dean, said that, well, she suspended it last week not because 43 Zionist organizations objected and hysterically lied and exaggerated about the purpose of the course and its impact on students. She said, well, they never shared the syllabus with me or the chair of the Ethnic Studies Department. But we know from other faculty members that Paul Hodway went through all of the steps that he was asked to, and the course was signed off by the Academic Senate. So Hodway, quoted here, says, I hope we can now focus on the challenging intellectual and political questions that this course seeks to address. I await an apology from Chancellor Dirks and Dean Hess. The university threw me under the bus and publicly blamed me without ever even contacting me. It seems that because I'm Palestinian studying Palestine, I'm guilty until proven innocent. To defend the course, we had to mobilize an international outcry of scholars and students to stand up for academic freedom. This never should have happened. Very well said. Liz Jackson, staff attorney with Palestine Legal, they represented Hodway. He said, this is a victory for Paul, who spent 8 months going through all the recommended and mandated procedures to facilitate a course. It's also a victory for the 26 students who enrolled and had their academic studies severely disrupted, and for students and scholars across the U.S. who are facing a coordinated attack on the right to speak and study freely about Palestine and Israel. As I teased a moment ago, I finally got my interview with Senator Bob Graham. I started requesting it back in July, but he's been busy with a lot of media interviews related to the so-called 28 pages that were finally released by the Obama administration on July 15th, with about 11% of the content still redacted. Senator Graham, when I asked him, said, well, it's been a long time since I read the memo without redaction, so he was unable to say whether these were significant redactions. But he certainly supports release of the complete document. And in an excerpt here from my in-depth interview with Senator Graham, he talks about, well, why there has been a delay in the release of the 28 pages.
I think there were a number of motivations for what was done. Some of them were incompetence, that institutions, governmental agencies, had acted in ways that clearly did not achieve the level of either professional or ethical standards that we would expect of a government organization. I think another part was the concern about upsetting the Saudis, making them less amenable to the United States if we made this information about their activities publicly available.
You can hear the full interview with Senator Graham. It's available for my subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, at TuneIn, at iTunes, Stitcher, Spreaker, wherever you find the Peter B. Collins podcast. Now, if you're listening on YouTube, I want to be clear, we're not able to deliver our interview podcast to YouTube because we can't run the subscription system there. So the only place to find our in-depth interviews is at peterbcollins.com. And it's subscribers who get first crack at the in-depth interviews. They're restricted for the first 14 days after I post them. So subscribers like Terry Paris, Don Cisney, Casey Condon, Julie Dupree, they're all big supporters of the Peter B. Collins podcast. They do more than they have to. And I invite you to join them. Come on over to my website. You click on the menu button that leads to become a subscriber. You click that, takes you to the sign-up page. That's where we have bonus books displayed for people who take out a brand new annual subscription and give me a mailing address in the continental U.S. But you can also choose $5, $10, $20 a month. You can make a one-time contribution using PayPal. And there's a P.O. box listed there. If you don't want to deal with PayPal, you can send me cash, check, money order in the mail. One guy crumbled up a $100 bill and put it in an envelope, and I unfolded it, and it spent just as good as anything that comes from PayPal. So I appreciate the support of the people who do support me, and I need more to sign up and keep it all going. Well, we have another tragic situation of an unarmed black man shot and killed by police officers, this time in Tulsa, captured on four different video cameras, but none with the, you know, complete end-to-end view, and there's still some questions about what occurred. But we know that 40-year-old Terrence Crutcher had called the cops himself because his car stalled out on the road and he was looking for assistance. Next, we look at videos and screen grabs, and we see Terrence Crutcher with his hands up, moving slowly, not in any threatening manner, never reaching for any kind of a presumed weapon. The police have confirmed there was no weapon on his person or in his vehicle. And then as a second officer arrives and starts to blast Crutcher with a taser, the first police officer to the scene, a woman whose name is Betty Shelby, shot and killed the unarmed man. Now, the officer who fired the shot, Betty Shelby, is white. And as we know, the suspect was black. The most encouraging aspect of this, which has to be in context, is that the police chief in Tulsa, Chuck Jordan, confirmed that Crutcher had no weapon. And he flatly stated that he is investigating this as a criminal act. Quote, "This is a criminal investigation. If you really expect me to carry this forward the way the community is asking, I can't discuss it further." So people who have seen the videos report that, you know, it's extremely disturbing. Now, there was a cover story floated. The videos have disproved it. The Tulsa Police Department initially told the public that Crutcher had ignored officers when they told him to raise his hands. And he reached back into his car, which was what prompted Officer Shelby to shoot and another officer, Tyler Turnbow, to fire his taser. So I do appreciate that the police chief there is treating this as a very serious matter, as a criminal event, and I hope that we get to the bottom of it. But this is something that happens far too often in this country. And we're not seeing things change for the better. Over on Capitol Hill today, Elizabeth Warren was just on fire, taking on the CEO of Wells Fargo Bank, John Stumpf. He's got a tough name. S-T-U-M-P-F. Stumpf. And Elizabeth Warren looked him in the eye and said he should resign. He should return at least part of his $19 million compensation from last year, and he should be criminally investigated over the heavy-handed sales tactics that pressured the low-level bankers making 30 to 60 grand a year to open fake credit card and bank accounts in the names of customers who hadn't asked for them. And these employees did it because of the incredible pressure to perform or lose their jobs. Now, Stumpf said, "I accept full responsibility for all unethical sales practices in our retail banking business, and I'm fully committed to doing everything possible to fix this issue, strengthen our culture, and take the necessary actions to restore our customers' trust." But Warren was having nothing of it. "Have you returned one nickel of the millions of dollars you were paid while this scam was going on?" He said, well, his board of directors will take care of that, and he told Warren, oh, it wasn't a scam. Just some sort of an accident. So then Warren said, well, look, in the last few years while you've been running the company, Wells Fargo stock went up by about $30 a share. You own $6.7 million, so you made $20 million, in part, because of this fraudulent behavior by your employees. So I applaud this effort. Stumpf is dodging, you know, all the important questions, saying that he accepts full responsibility, his board of directors will have to make these decisions that he is dodging. And Shane Larson over at the CWA says, Wells Fargo is trying to blame the 5,300 workers they've fired as a responsible party here. That's simply not true. There's no way that more than 5,000 workers acted individually on more than 2 million transactions. This behavior comes from the top at Wells Fargo. And while I have my differences with Elizabeth Warren, I'm still bitter that she wouldn't endorse Bernie Sanders in the primaries. And I also think that when people floated her for vice president, well, it was a leap too far. I don't agree with her views on foreign policy. But when it comes to domestic issues, the economy, and Wall Street, I'm right behind Elizabeth Warren. And I applaud her for helping create the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And it's the CFPB that has fined Wells Fargo $185 million for these fraudulent accounts. But on the same day those fines were announced, House Speaker Paul Ryan put up a tweet, "The CFPB supposedly exists to protect you, but instead it tries to micromanage your everyday life." And this is to create some tailwinds for a bad piece of legislation called the Choice Act. The Choice Act would eliminate the Bureau's examination and enforcement authority for more than half of the banks it currently oversees. It would allow states to block new rules being developed by the Bureau to protect against abuses in payday loans and car title loans. Yeah, the Republicans in Congress want to lift regulations on predatory money people, lenders primarily. And the bill would also prevent this Bureau from carrying out rules being developed to limit the use of forced arbitration, which disadvantages consumers and employees by keeping our disputes out of court. So keep an eye on the Choice Act. It is presumed that if it came to Obama's desk, he would veto it. But either of the major party presidential candidates, we can't be sure. Barack Obama gave his final speech to the United Nations General Assembly in New York today, and he called for a course correction. A course correction in the march to an integrated world, saying the gains made in recent decades were threatened by uncertainty and unease and strife. We cannot dismiss these visions. They are powerful. They reflect dissatisfaction among too many of our citizens. Now, on the one hand, Obama appeared to be somewhat honest and frank in laying out the problems, some of the promises he made that he hasn't been able to keep. But on the other hand, I think he's sending a warning to the ruling class that the peasants are getting restless. Now, in a sweeping tour of the world, the president confronted the sectarian chaos in the Middle East, Russia's alleged aggression toward its neighbors, China's disputes with other Asian countries. He didn't articulate any new policies. And regarding Syria, he said, in a place like Syria where there's no military victory to be had, we're going to have to pursue the hard work of diplomacy. Now, that phrase right there, it's got to be sitting pretty uncomfortably with the people who heard it in the General Assembly. Because the Security Council was called to an emergency session on Saturday night after a U.S. bombing raid during the ceasefire killed a reported 80-plus Syrian troops on a base that appeared to be well-defined as off-limits because of the ceasefire and the deal between the U.S. and Russia. Another quote from the president, "In a world that left the age of empire behind, we see Russia attempting to recover lost glory through force." How hypocritical does that come across to people who view the United States as the empire builder, the imperialist? And so I'll wait to watch some of the speech and maybe read more excerpts from it. But it has to be hard for him to be on his way out and see so many issues, so many contentious problems that have actually gotten worse as he and his administration have attempted to address them. And here is the other very live open wound. Yesterday, Syria announcing or at least accepting that this one-week ceasefire was not holding, they apparently launched an attack on the United Nations convoy headed for Aleppo. There were 31 trucks, and 18 of them were totally destroyed. Now, what is really curious about the corporate media reporting on this is they don't even make an effort to tell us who blew up the humanitarian supply convoy. It could have been the Syrian Air Force. It could have been the Russians. And yes, it could have been the United States. But this is one of those weird reports where they talk around that issue. Quote, "Witnesses said multiple strikes had hit the convoy as workers were unloading aid and then hit rescue workers who arrived to help. That's called a double tap. We double tap on drone strikes. Syria double taps on barrel bombs." And so I find this baffling that in this New York Times report that runs to three printed pages, 8.5 by 11, they don't tell us who conducted that bombing raid. I'm scratching my head over this story that was tipped to me by Colleen McGuire. And the story comes from the Huffington Post Australian edition. It's called HuffPost Australia. And it reports that a young Jewish American man who lives in Florida has been charged with pretending to be an Australian-based Islamic State jihadist. And this is after an FBI joint investigation with the Australian Federal Police. The 20-year-old's name is Joshua Ryan Goldberg. He lives with his parents in Florida. He's accused of posing online as Australia Witness, an IS supporter who publicly called for a series of attacks against individuals and events in Western countries. In recent days, this Australia Witness has claimed online that he's working with other jihadists to plan attacks in Australia and the United States. He distributed pictures of a bomb that he was working on with 2 pounds of explosives inside, he claimed. And early last Friday, Goldberg, who is non-Muslim and has no real-world links with extremism, we're told, was arrested at his home by Florida police for distribution of information relating to explosive, destructive devices, and weapons of mass destruction. Haven't heard anything about his FBI informant or handler there. But we have learned that the man accused of planting 2 pressure cooker bombs in Manhattan and pipe bombs in other locations in New Jersey over last weekend, his name is Ahmad Rahami, that he has prior contact with the FBI. And I'm not saying I told you so or anything like that, but yesterday when I covered this story, I noted that there was no mention of an FBI informant and was waiting for that proverbial shoe to drop. So he may not have been under any kind of surveillance or monitoring in recent weeks. But 2 years ago, his father, Muhammad Rahami, says that he went to the FBI and told them that his son was a terrorist. And this is the quote verbatim. 2 years ago, I go to the FBI because my son was doing really bad, okay? But they check almost 2 months. They say he's okay. He's clean. He's not a terrorist. I say okay. Now they say he is a terrorist. I say okay. Now, I'm not making fun of his limited English here. But my inference from this is that the father is clueless. He can't figure out why his son got involved and who did what and why. And I want to be clear here that at this point I'm in pure speculation mode. But the pattern of frame-ups by the FBI of so-called domestic terrorists is so obvious and consistent. That given that he was in touch with the FBI and they said that they cleared him 2 years ago, well, there's every possibility that he became an informant himself. Now, I'm only saying it's a possibility because the information they offer in the biographies that we have so far on the young Rahami are that he made a trip back to his native Afghanistan a couple of years ago and returned a different person. He started praying more and wearing Muslim robes, and they found him to be a much more serious guy because previously he knocked up his high school girlfriend and used to race around in souped-up Honda cars. So at this point, I remain skeptical. There's a lot we don't know about these events and about this young man, but we cannot rule out some sort of nefarious involvement by our government. Chelsea Manning published a heart-wrenching op-ed at The Guardian today. She writes, "Last week I was given the good news that the Defense Department will grant my request to see a surgeon for treatment related to my gender dysphoria. I don't have anything in writing, but I hope this is going to happen." Then she says, "That same week, last week, I was also given bad news. I may be punished for a suicide attempt in July. For the past week, I've been busy preparing for my disciplinary board. This administrative board has the power to sentence me for the indefinite solitary confinement. Preparing to defend yourself for a disciplinary board is time-consuming. You got to research, collect evidence, organize a defense. It's stressful. I am facing this alone. I am not allowed to have a lawyer or anyone else with me. Last week, I was escorted to view the evidence before the board. There are now nearly 100 pages. I'm not allowed to copy them. I can only look at them for an hour. In the evidence, I saw a photograph of myself shortly after my suicide attempt. Seeing this photograph has haunted me for the past week. It has disturbed me. It sends a chill down my spine. This hurt me more than any physical injury or hardship I have lived through." Wow. The military is just being so cruel to Chelsea Manning. And I appreciate that she is able to express this and that what's left of the First Amendment permits her to get it published. But it's really tragic to see this done in our names. I noted on Friday a shift at the New York Times where they actually used the word L-I-E in connection to Donald Trump. They actually printed it twice Friday and again on Saturday. And the new public editor over at the New York Times, Liz Spade, explores the decision that was made to use it. The headline read, "Trump gives up a lie but refuses to repent." That's related to the birther story about President Obama. And listeners complained about this. One said, "Well, you know, I actually agree with the Times assessment that Trump is lying, but this is too much. Apparently the tradition that the front page is just news has ended because such phrases as Trump gives up a lie and refuses to repent are opinions that belong on the editorial page." John Neal of Greensboro, North Carolina, a reader, said that he isn't advocating use of the word lie, but he wants sharp, blunt terms when a candidate is dishonest. And I agree. I think the Times is way too cautious. And as I've pointed out, they are not even-handed. We haven't seen them use the word that Hillary Clinton has lied about anything, and we are pretty clear that in cases she has. So the political editor at the Times is quoted here, "A lie is different from the spin, exaggerations, and squabbling between candidates that are commonplace in politics. It is not a word we will use lightly. It's not used for matters of opinion, but only when the facts are demonstrably clear and intentionality is important." Did they lie with intent? So I think it's refreshing just to hear this discussed. They wouldn't call Bush a liar over WMD and other obvious fabrications that he used. And they are so timid in using it in political discourse when lies are the currency of this year's political cycle. And speaking of lies and liars, the prosecution of the associates of New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who were on trial over the George Washington Bridge closures a few years back, are making it very clear that Christie has lied all along. And the euphemisms in covering this remain in place. I did a search of Christie and Bridge at the New York Times website, and the closest we come is to a quote in a headline that reads, "He just flat out lied," aide says of Christie and the Bridge Lane closings. But the Times itself has not used the word lie in any of the articles that I've read about Chris Christie and the Bridgegate scandal. And I don't think it's a matter of doubt anymore at this stage. Let me know your thoughts about this. It can be a tricky issue, and sometimes calling somebody a liar isn't accurate and is just used as a form of verbal assault. But sometimes calling a lie is the best thing we can do. Thanks for joining me for this free news and comment podcast. You're free to share it far and wide, and it's now available every day on YouTube.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.